Hello, and welcome to the Headlines Podcast, a podcast about some of the interesting, important, and entertaining stories you might have missed in local newspapers this week. It's a bit like a newspaper review, but for local newspapers and news websites. I'm Chloe Lavasuch, and it's the week ending Sunday, February 14th, 2021. It's been the week in which China blocked BBC World News within its borders after reports on the persecution of ethnic minority groups and the COVID-19 pandemic. Donald Trump was acquitted in his second impeachment trial for his role in the 6th of January attack on the US Capitol. And it's been really cold and snowy. In Southend, the sea froze over, or rather the waves on the shore, as some rather beautiful pictures in The Echo show. And in London, the River Thames froze over at Teddington Lock. And I think it's been a time when the British are getting back their taste for slightly silly news stories, following the viral footage of a Zoom parish council meeting descending into a hilarious argument in Hanforth, which saw national journalists rushing to Cheshire to meet council clerk Jackie Weaver. This week we've had a US lawyer stuck on a cat filter on Zoom during a court hearing tell the judge, "I'm here live, I'm not a cat." And everyone went a bit nuts over Weetabix suggesting people try baked beans on top of their cereal. It's also been a busy week in local newspapers. In this week's episode, we'll hear about a farmer who put on a music festival for his herd of cows, a couple who moved into a horse box that they turned into a home after struggling to save for a mortgage, and the story behind a house with a 25-foot fiberglass sculpture of a shark sticking out of the roof. I was also lucky enough to be joined by Nick Pollard, former head of Sky News and now a trustee of the John Schofield Trust, an organisation working to improve social mobility and diversity in journalism. Nick has worked in journalism and broadcast media for more than 50 years. He's run news organisations, launched channels in the UK and overseas, managed multimedia companies, chaired a major inquiry and been a main board member at Ofcom, the industry regulator. He was very generous with his time and shared stories about covering some of the biggest news stories, certainly of my lifetime. You can skip ahead to about minute 10 to hear that interview in full if you want to skip past my roundup of local news stories from the week. Links to all of the stories in this week's episode can be found in the description, or follow us on Twitter at The Headlines Pod. And as always, if you enjoy the podcast and want to keep seeing stories like this reported in the news, please support your local newspaper and news websites and their journalists. For now though, let's get on with the podcast. First up this week, a photograph of hundreds of people queuing for food from a soup kitchen in heavy snow has led to more than £62,000 being raised for the charity. This story is from Glasgow Live, and it's by journalists Craig Williams and Holly Lennon. The picture shows more than 200 people queuing for food from community group Kindness Homeless Street Team Glasgow. They say the number of people they're helping has nearly tripled during the pandemic. Since the news website published the photo, more than £60,000 has been donated. London bus drivers are to go on strike over wage cuts, which they fear will take up to £2,500 a year off their pay. This story is by Local Democracy reporter Owen Shepherd from the East London and West Essex Guardian. It says Transport for London confirmed that 47 London bus drivers have died after catching COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic. 2,000 drivers are set to go on strike. They're employed by three bus companies owned by French multinational RATP Group. They operate routes in South, West and North West London under contracts with the TfL. Unite the Union says drivers would no longer be paid during their breaks or for any time that isn't spent behind the wheel of a bus when they are logged in. And the new contracts would see drivers start and end their shifts at different bus stops rather than at bus garages. They would be told by an app which bus stop to commute to for each shift. Now for a story about a house on a very lovely looking street in Oxford with a shark sticking out of its roof. I love this story, partly because it's not about coronavirus, but also because when you see the picture, it almost looks like the shark has been photoshopped on. This week, the Oxford Mail did a story about the Headington shark, which it calls Oxford's quirkiest landmark. The article, by journalist Miranda Norris, says the 25-foot fiberglass shark sculpture was commissioned by American-born journalist Bill Hine, who used to work at BBC Oxford and the Oxford Mail. Mr. Hine apparently got the idea while sitting on a doorstep opposite his new home, chatting with his sculptor friend John Buckley over a glass of wine, when he asked, "Can you do something to liven it up?" He also said the sculpture was intended to be a protest against the American bombings of Libya, and also described it as a statement about nuclear weapons. So on Saturday, August 9th, 1986, at 5 a.m, the shark was taken to the street on a tractor trailer where a large crane was waiting, and it was slotted into the roof. As you can imagine, a six-year planning row immediately erupted. The council refused planning permission for the shark, but Mr. Hine appealed to the Secretary of State, who actually came out in favour of the sculpture. He said the council's fears about a proliferation with sharks and heaven knows what else crashing through roofs all over the city were exaggerated. The house is now listed as an Airbnb rental. Staffordshire Police collected more than £121,000 from victims of crime in 2020. This is a story by local democracy reporter Joe Byrne for the Stoke Sentinel. It says police collected £121,560 in administration fees from victims. The fees were charged to drivers whose vehicles had been stolen, damaged, or involved in an accident, and then recovered to a garage, sometimes for forensic investigation. Apparently, the costs are set by government, with a £150 charge to remove most vehicles and a £20 a day charge storage fee for cars and light fans. Apparently, victims can get their money back if the criminal is caught and prosecuted. But the latest data shows that 9 out of 10 car theft cases were dropped in Stoke-on-Trent in 2019 to 2020. A police spokesperson said they carry out checks and investigations on vehicles involved in crimes when necessary, and charges are not applied while the force is awaiting for an examination. Here's a story that says something about how difficult it is to get on the property ladder now if you're a young person. A couple have moved into a horse box that they turned into a home after struggling to save for a mortgage. This story is from the Argus in Brighton by journalist Rose Locke. It says the couple, Sophie Frykfors and Lally Castiglione, looked at alternative ways of living while paying rents of about £2,000 a month in Brighton. Sophie, an architectural designer, and Lally, who runs a hairdresser's, bought a horse box and have turned it into an incredible looking home. They did it all themselves, according to the story, including the electrics and the plumbing, with the help of YouTube tutorials. The home has a sofa which turns into a dining table and spare bed for guests, has a kitchen, a fully functioning bathroom, and an upstairs bedroom. Sophie said they did underestimate how long it would take, but that they have no regrets, and when lockdown lifts, they hope to explore more of the UK in their new mobile home. And finally for your stories this week, this one's a bit of a PR stunt, but it's a pretty fantastic one, and it's from the West Country, so I couldn't resist. A farmer has put on a music festival for his cows. As a side note, in other West Country musical dairy farm news, if you're missing Glastonbury Festival, you will soon be able to buy cheese made from milk from the cows that live at the festival site all year round. It was reported this week that Michael Evis's Worthy Farm in Somerset has launched its own cheddar cheese. But back to the other cows, as it were. This is a story from Devon Live by journalist Charlotte Vowles. It says a dairy farm in West Dorset came up with a plan to boost the cows' mood in lockdown with some live entertainment. Do the cows even know there's a lockdown, or do they mind? Anyway, local musician Ben Waters visited to play a live set, and from the pictures, the cows do look pretty happy. Apparently cows enjoy music, and listening to it can improve the quality of their milk, according to staff at the dairy. Okay, that's your lot for possibly more silly than serious local news this week. Next up, Nick Pollard was kind enough to speak to me about his career, starting out in local newspapers at the age of 17, his thoughts on diversity in journalism, and his experiences reporting on international news stories, including the death of Princess Diana, the 9/11 attacks, and the London bombings. Here we go.
But if I start, by asking you how the past year's been for you and what sort of news you've been watching and reading and what you think about some of the coverage of the pandemic.
Well, I've always been a big consumer of news, as you might imagine, having worked in the industry for the past 50 years or so. So I still watch a lot of television news. I get the Times every day as a newspaper. I often buy other papers as well. I like the FT, you read the Daily Mail. And I read a lot of online news as well. I'm a recent subscriber to the New York Times online, which is absolutely fantastic and fascinating the way they hold nothing back when it comes to criticism of Donald Trump. And there's a big issue within journalism, as you know, about how committed news organizations should be, whether they should call out politicians and other public figures as liars, and the New York Times does, CNN does, something we're slightly warier of, I think, in the UK. But having said that, I consumed a lot of news, which I do find it hard sometimes to watch endless coronavirus misery coverage, and I don't suppose I'm alone in the public with that. There has been some absolutely brilliant coverage. And just in the past couple of weeks, I've been watching a lot of that for the Royal Television Society's Journalism Awards. And some of the journalism, some of the coverage of coronavirus issues has been remarkable, incredibly brave, and utterly valuable to the public. But as I say, a lot of it has been pretty hard to watch day in and day out.
Are there any reports in particular that spring to mind? I know that the BBC has been going into ITU units quite a lot recently to really sort of speak to not just the doctors and the nurses, but also cleaners and porters.
Brilliant coverage by Clive Myrie of the BBC. And interestingly, in the RTS Journalism Awards, there is a similar series that he did in a London hospital a few months ago, really quite remarkable, and one of the likely finalists of the awards. Two other things that stood out for me: Stuart Ramsay's coverage on Sky very early on, I think back in March, in one of the hospitals in Bergamo, Italy, which was really the first time we'd seen anything like that. And the message very much from the Italians was, you need to know about this because it's coming your way in the next few weeks. Of course it was. And a very good series by Fergus Walsh of the BBC, really the first time that we saw inside an ICU at a COVID ward. And as you know, my wife and your aunt were both intensive care unit nurses some years ago in London. So very much a personal sort of feeling, without a doubt. But there's been other great coverage as well, away from the sort of heartland of hospitals in care homes. Nick Martin of Sky done a wonderful series about a care home and the strains that puts on staff and patients. Heroic work, absolutely. And Andy Davis of Channel 4 has done wonderful coverage way away from London in South Wales, showing the sort of devastating effect on communities. So Britain has been well served, I would say, by its journalists. And of course, same is true of newspapers as well, but I've focused a lot on broadcast.
It's been a year where there's been quite a lot to celebrate in journalism, not just in coronavirus, but obviously also that Robert Moore report of the storming of Capitol Hill was absolutely incredible journalism. So the podcast focuses on local newspapers as well. And as you say, there's been quite a lot of reporting, not just based in London, but in the regions. I know you started your career in local newspapers while you were still in your teens. Am I right in believing that?
Yes, I'm afraid you're right. It's now 52 years since I started my career on the Birkenhead News, which was part of the Liverpool Echo Group. And it really does seem an utterly different era to today. When I started, even in the little area across the Mersey from Liverpool called the Wirral, we had seven newspapers in our group. We published twice a week, The others, the Birkenhead News was twice a week, the others published weekly. And on the Liverpool side, there was a similar group of local newspapers running all the way up from Liverpool north to Southport and beyond. And of course, every conurbation and every small town or village had a local paper in those days. And not only was it a fantastic service to the public, and a real watchdog for local democracy and local information, but of course it was a wonderful training ground and feeding ground for the media generally. Of course, it wasn't just local papers. There were local radio stations, and I moved to local radio after I'd done my stint on local papers. I worked on Radio Merseyside, and I worked on the first commercial station there, Radio City, which started in 1974. And we had a newsroom of 20 people. We had a local government reporter, a political reporter, industrial reporter. We had a big sports team, had a crime specialist, and we produced genuine news in bulk and in quality. But as you will know, sadly, so much of that has gone. And if you look at, say, the big regional papers, Liverpool Echo and the Manchester Evening News, Birmingham Post and Mail, they all had circulations over 300, nearly 400,000 in those days. And people were buying those papers with cash. And as you will know, now, if you look at those areas, most of those papers where they exist have actual newspaper circulations of 25,000, 30,000. Now, of course, they will point to big online readership, but of course, that doesn't translate into revenue, and the advertising revenue for those papers has largely disappeared as well. But at least they exist. A lot of the smaller papers, like the Birkenhead News and the ones that I worked on, they've sort of disappeared. And there's no doubt that the public, in my view, is much more poorly served now. And I know you work in local newspaper journalism, but it's a battle because the owners of those papers throughout the country are struggling to survive. And you might say rather brutally, well, cry me a river. You know, they've made money in the past. But actually, in the end, it's the public who suffer. If they don't have a good service of news from the courts, from councils, from local commerce, from local sport, and just from human interest stories as well. So I think it's a shame. Other forms of journalism are popping up, of course, and that's fantastic. But I do rather regret the passing of real local grassroots journalism that paid its way.
Do you have any thoughts of what the future of local newspapers and local journalism could look like? Have you got any ideas of what you would like to see? I suppose any suggestions at all for people working in the industry who love where they live, but see that it's a challenging environment?
Yes, it is. And I would love to say that there is, light at the end of the tunnel, and there is there are grounds for optimism, but I don't think I can. I mean, one thing that we will talk about, I think, is not only the effect on the public, but the effect on journalism as well. And the number of people who like me, learnt their trade, made their mistakes, if you like, with nobody looking, you might say, or at least the ability to recover from them, on those local newspapers and radio stations. But in terms how to serve people with local journalism, I went to a conference in Cardiff a couple of years ago about local journalism. And there was one solitary example of somebody who had started a local paper, in fact, in Caerphilly in South Wales. And I think he was selling about 8,000 copies a week. He was just about breaking even. It was a genuine small-scale commercial paper. But I think there was himself and there were a couple of other people. He just about broke even. But that was the only real example of a genuinely new independent startup. All the other examples that were given of effective local journalism, they relied completely on sponsorship and contributions. And it really came from three different sources. It was either from organizations like Facebook or Twitter, who might put in YouTube, other organizations, who might sort of hand over some of the colossal profits they're making to try and encourage local journalism, or it was from some local sponsorship, or the other source, and it's not necessarily recognized as a source, people working for free to make this happen, they're sponsoring it themselves. They're sponsoring it with their time and the wages that they are foregoing. They're basically underwriting it. So, as you know better than I do, there is good local journalism. Some of it's still in properly organized, proper commercial organizations, but an awful lot of it is underpinned by voluntary effort. And if you were being cruel, you might say it's to some extent a bit more like a hobby than it is a job. And it's difficult, I think people have to accept it's difficult, to do genuine investigative, holding organisations and groups and politicians to account. It's difficult to do that if you're not working on a paid basis. But life changes. Social media is everything. There is no shortage of commentary and opinion and observational reporting, if you like, about what's going on in people's localities. I'm not sure it's quite the same as journalism.
I know a lot of people say that they really enjoyed their sort of initial years in journalism, working in local newspapers and sort of local radio stations. Do you feel that way? Do you look back on it fondly? Do you have any sort of good memories of that time?
I have only good memories of it. I mean, I started when I was still 17, as I say, on the Burton's News, and I was incredibly lucky to work for a group of people who, I mean, actually, they're a bit older than me, but looking back at it now, they were incredibly young as well. They were largely in their 20s, and I learned everything from them. They were mentors to me, and actually, we're still in touch as a group 50-something years later. We're all knocking on a bit now. But I worked then, I worked for a freelance agency, and I learned an awful lot there. I worked for BBC Radio. Then I went back to local radio in Liverpool for a few years. And it was all a fantastic learning curve. And there is absolutely nothing like hands-on learning. And then after that, I went on to BBC Television News in the late 1970s. But one of the things that I noticed, which I thought was very interesting, there was a recent, very informative House of Lords report on journalism and diversity and journalism training and so on. And one of the points it made that I thought was very interesting was that in what you might call the old days, in my day, most journalism training was done on the job. I went and did two block release courses during my 3 years of apprenticeship there, 6 weeks in the first year and 6 weeks in the third year at a place called Harris College in Preston, which is now has the grand title of the University of Central Lancashire. And I did shorthand, I did law, I did newspaper practice, and so on. But most of what I learned was on the job by doing it by from my peers and my betters. Nowadays, nearly all journalistic training is done in universities and colleges. And as you know, it's pretty much impossible to get into journalism in any recognized form without a degree, and for a lot of people, without a master's degree, a postgrad degree as well. And you might say that makes for a much better educated journalistic cadre. You might say that they know more about what they're doing. I personally don't think it's a great step. And I saw that something like 98% of all journalists under 30 now have a degree. And okay, there's a lot more people going to university, of course. About 50% of all young people go to university now. But I have an uneasy feeling that it is shutting out a large group of society from participating in journalism. I mean, I had a couple of rather ropey A-levels when I started. I didn't have a degree, obviously. And a lot of people of my generation got into journalism that way. That way is pretty much closed completely now. And as you know, there's a lot of soul searching and thinking going on in the journalistic community about diversity, not only sexual diversity, gender diversity, racial as well, but in a way, just as important, maybe more important, social mobility, whether there is class diversity in journalism. I think most people agree there isn't enough.
Nowadays, I know that we haven't been able to accommodate work experience students for quite a long time now, and that seems to be similar in a lot of the papers that I used to work at and that I know reporters at. I mean, work experience seems like the most basic level of just getting in to see if it might be something that you're interested in.
Yes, and I mean, there's obviously a big problem with work experience at the moment because of lockdown and isolation. So it's really gone out of the window. But the other problem with work experience, which I think people have recognised, is that it's on several fronts, it's quite elitist. And a lot of it, and I've been guilty of this in the past, A lot of it is who you know. So if you know somebody in journalism, it's very easy for a parent to say, look, could you take my son or daughter in and just give them a couple of weeks work experience? If you don't know anybody in journalism, it's hard to get in. Now, some schools and universities have quite a good pipeline, if you like, and that's good in itself. But the other thing is you then get into the issue of internships. What you might call sort of longer term work experience, which might be for a month or 3 months or more. And as you know, in the past, quite a lot of these have been unpaid. Now, I think that's completely immoral. And I don't think any news organization should be doing that, even if young people are volunteering to do unpaid internships. And one of the reasons for that is, well, it's blatantly exploitative for one thing. But the other thing, of course, is the people who can afford to do unpaid internships are likely to be those from better off families who can sub them, maybe have them living at home. And again, that's something else that excludes other people. So I'm glad to say that more journalistic organisations, where they're doing work experience or internship, are now recognising it absolutely has to be paid in some form or another, even if it's only expenses and a little bit of money, say for a midday meal, travelling. It should be more than that, but that's better than nothing. But you know, we've got a long way to go. We really have. And you know, perhaps I would get a plug in for the John Scofield Trust. I'm a trustee of that, and it does excellent work in mentoring and supporting young people in the very early stages of their career or just setting out in a journalistic career, particularly from ethnic minorities, people with disabilities, and people from less privileged social classes. And we have been able to open some doors and get people started and just support them when they might be flagging in their efforts to get in and get on. But it's only a modest thing. We mentor and support about 40, 45 people a year. And we do an online mentoring thing for kids and university students. More of that needs to be done, without a doubt.
Do you have any examples of what young people might see as their barriers to getting into journalism? I know I've spoken to people from different ethnic backgrounds in the past who are reporters now, who say that for them, it wasn't even something that they had considered as a career path. So it's not even necessarily that they'd sought out, great organisations like the John Scofield Trust, because to them, it wasn't even an option.
Yeah, yes, it's a really good point that the people that we mentor, if you like, with face-to-face personal mentorships, they are slightly older. So they are perhaps in their early 20s, and they are people committed to having a go at least to at a journalistic career, or they may be in the first couple of years of work at an organisation. The online mentoring we do is for people perhaps in the sixth form who might be just thinking about journalism as a career, and just to give them some ideas and pointers and this, that and the other. You make a really good point about the barriers to entry. And there are a couple of things, really. One is that, quite simply, people from less privileged classes, as I say, they won't know anybody in the business. They won't find a door, let alone being able to open it. They just won't be able to find the door at all. And that is a colossal barrier. And that if they manage to get in, they won't know anybody. The other thing is, there was a fascinating programme on the BBC a couple of months ago by the BBC's media correspondent, Amal Rajan, who I know has thought a lot about this. Very impressive guy. And he did a programme about why, in particular, ethnic minority young people don't make it easily into journalism. And in fact, why sometimes they struggle in other careers, other professions as well. And he was making the point that when you're going for an interview, you need confidence, you need presence, and you need what he called polish. And he was making the point with some examples that young people, particularly from public schools with private education behind them, they sort of automatically pick up this polish. And a lot of very bright, very motivated people from either ethnic backgrounds or less socially privileged backgrounds, they don't always have this, what you might call, polish, or they can't necessarily produce the convincing performance at an interview that other people can easily. And this is all, I guess, to do with the class system. There's a whole lot of factors involved. But it is one thing that I think can hold people back from making the breakthrough, even when they're absolutely brimful of ability and knowledge and ambition. And the education system and, I guess, organisations like the John Scofield Trust need to help people get to the point where they can show what their real potential is.
I find that to be a bit of a shame, really, because I think that journalism is one of those jobs where it pays to be not necessarily polished. You know, you find that you can speak to a lot more people if you're more of a human being and you're more part of your community and you know a lot of people. And that's how you, at the end of the day, that's how you get a good story. And that's what it's about.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that is one of the things that I think you learn instinctively in local journalism. I mean, when I left school and started on the paper, I mean, the idea of going and knocking on people's doors and talking to them, it was horrifying. But you learn by doing it. And you're absolutely right. One of the great lessons I learned was having to go and knock on people's doors after they'd had a death in the family, to just get a story about the person for an article, perhaps ask for some photos. And of course, the first time you do it, you're absolutely dreading it because you think you are imposing on these people in an awful way. But you learn that if you approach people in a human sort of way, actually they want to talk. They will welcome you into their house. And I remember doing this in Burton Head once, and I was still pretty young, and I knocked on this woman's door, and she took me in, and her husband had died. She said, "Would you like to see him?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And she had him laid out in the front room in his coffin, in an open coffin. And I went, "Now look," and we stood there together, and she was having a little sniffle, and I think I shed a tear as well, and. And I said, "Well, okay, it's fantastic." And I wrote the story, and I said, "Have you got any pictures?" And she got the family photo album out. We spent a couple of hours going through it. And the number one lesson you have to learn is you make sure if you borrow a photograph, you send it back, because that's a heartbreaking thing to lose. But talking to people and and being with people is a fundamental part of journalism. And I'm afraid there are an enormous number of people supposedly doing journalism these days who never do that. They never knock on a door. They might phone somebody up, but they spend nearly their entire working lives at a desk staring at a screen. Now, that's not journalism. I mean, that is word processing, I think. And we are the worst for it.
Obviously, you've spoken about the start of your career working on a local newspaper. I mean, you've really worked your way right up the ladder to the top of the industry. I mean, I'm quite interested to hear...
And off the other side.
I mean, you were head of Sky News for 10 years. You were executive producer of ITN News at 10. But what does that take, both as a person and sort of, I guess, as a day-to-day job? Presumably, it's quite different from knocking on someone's door down the street to ask if you can do a tribute to their recently passed away husband.
Yeah, yes, it is. I loved newspaper reporting and radio reporting, and without blowing my own trumpet, I think I did it pretty well. When I got into television, it was very clear to me early on that I wouldn't make a particularly good television reporter. I didn't have either the sort of personality or the attitude or the confidence on camera to do it. So I spent my entire career in television working as a sort of producer and editor behind the scenes. And you know, what do you have to do? I mean, it comes down largely to journalistic skills, which I'd learned in that sort of previous decade, the ability to learn from other people, of course. I think hard work, long hours, without a doubt, the ability to know what a story is and how today's version of that story has got to be different from yesterday's. I think also the ability to get the best out of other people working for you is an important thing. And I know when I don't think it's unfair for me to say this, when I went to Sky News as head of Sky News in 1996, there was a not particularly good atmosphere there. And one of the ways that showed itself was whenever anything went wrong, and of course things go wrong in 24-hour news, they just do because that's life. Somebody had to be found to be criticised and, you know, hauled over the coals, told what an idiot they were. And so there was a sort of atmosphere of fear. People were desperately fearful of making a mistake, which meant that they wouldn't ever take any risks. And rightly or wrongly, that's never been my way of working. I think you get more out of people by praise and thanking them for what they're doing than by bollocking them all the time. And that doesn't mean to say that you accept mistakes and you have a lower standard, lower threshold for accuracy and so on. But I always thought if the only time anybody hears from you is when they've made a mistake, they're not going to like you. They're not going to be working at their best. If you tell them well done and you praise them when they do good stuff, and they're doing loads of that all the time, when you come along and say, look, that was a bit of a mess, what are we going to do to make sure we don't do that next time? They're going to pick it up. They're going to accept that. I always thought the best example was what we used to call text producers, you know, who are the people, they're usually young people who write all the stuff that ticks along the bottom of the screen, the ticker. And they might be doing a 3-hour shift. And if there is one spelling mistake on that, everybody's saying, oh, bloody useless. Well, you know, what you don't get praise for is the 200 stories that you've written in that time, which have been spelt correctly, spot on journalistically, and produced really, really well. If you don't get thanked for that, but you get told off because you've got one spelling mistake in one word, that's demotivating it. That is not motivation. And motivation, I think, is really important.
Do you think that taking measured risks in news reporting and trying to find different ways to do things is an important part of the job? And do you have any sort of examples that you'd be happy to share of when things might have gone not quite to plan?
Oh, gosh. But the answer to your first part of your question is definitely yes. Innovation is vital. I mean, for one thing, it just makes the job more interesting and more exciting. And technology over the past 20, 30 years, as you know, has allowed people to innovate. In 1986, when I was at ITN, I went to produce the ITV coverage of the Queen's historic visit to China. And we, in those days, you certainly couldn't broadcast live from a mobile phone, because actually there weren't any mobile phones. And satellite dishes were huge, great, unwieldy things. And we took our satellite dish out there, which with all the kit weighed about 3 tons. And we hired a helicopter from the Chinese Air Force, and we slung this 3-ton load underneath the helicopter in a big net, and we flew it up to the Great Wall of China, and we put this satellite dish on the top turret. And I can vividly remember being there standing, staring out with binoculars, looking for this helicopter, and it finally arrived. And the net, because it was windy, the net was swaying back and forwards, and I thought, all my guys, the engineers, were going to get knocked off and that would be it, and they'd all get killed. But we did that. And that's the sort of thing gives you a fantastic buzz. I'll give you an example of something that didn't work. When the Zeebrugge ferry disaster happened, which is probably maybe before you were born, but a major, major story, which I think was 1987, a passenger ferry went down off the Belgian port of Zeebrugge, and about 100 and something people were drowned. Terrible thing. I was over there with ITN, and we had an idea which probably was not a good idea on balance. We'd done all this sort of rather good live stuff from little boats around the ship, and we were very pleased with that, and we'd done that better than the BBC. Okay, I'm going to have to say this. I had this idea rather than blaming anybody else, that we had a very dynamic Belgian cameraman, and he had this idea, or rather he agreed to the idea, that we would send a frogman out with an underwater camera to film inside the ship. And there are all sorts of reasons why we shouldn't have done it, partly because the ship was full of dead bodies and so on. But anyway, we went, and the frogman actually swam up inside the ship. And unfortunately for him and us, there was a guy there from the salvage company who had a gun trained on him. And he said, either you get back in the water and swim away, or I'm going to shoot you. This is a ship full of dead people, and you should not be here. And it was a bad error of judgment on my part. And actually, I shouldn't be talking about it, because I don't think that it's ever been, I don't think it's ever come out 30 something years later. No, it's an example of we all make mistakes. We all have good calls and bad calls. And, you know, we talk about the good calls. I remember we had a great stroke of luck when the London bombs went off, which was, I think it was 2005. July the 7th, we had a very good helicopter setup, and the helicopter had been up in Scotland for the G7 meeting, where there were some quite big demonstrations, and we'd got good mileage out of that. And then, as it happened, it was the day when London was announced as the venue for the 2012 Olympics. So we brought the helicopter back to London to shoot some nice aerials over the area of East London where the Olympics were going to be held. And the helicopter was actually in the air over East London when news came through of those bombs on the underground and on London buses. So we had the first aerials of the scene, of people streaming out of the stations, of the buses and the ambulances and so on. Really a pure stroke of logistical luck. But sometimes it breaks for you, sometimes it doesn't. And, you know, plenty of times it doesn't.
I have to say, I remember, I can still see in my mind that coverage from Sky News of the July 7 bombings, and also the coverage of Raoul Moat, the gunman, and Gaza, and also the Soham murders. It was a very good story for the Sky as well. I mean, a lot of that is Sky News footage and coverage that's all in our sort of collective memory of huge news.
We were very competitive, and I think you have to be. I mean, we were obviously in competition with BBC News Channel. There was, for a while, as you know, an ITN News Channel, which did fantastic things with very, very modest resources. But sadly, I think ITV / ITN decided that they couldn't sustain that. But we were, and I think probably Sky News still is, we were ultra competitive. So when there was a big court case and a big verdict coming out, we would use all sorts of, I was going to say tricks, but all sorts of techniques to make sure that we got it first. And even if we were first by 3 or 4 seconds in flashing a verdict or flashing a story, that was enough for us. You know, that was the motivation we needed. Now, of course, the other issue is you've got to be right as well. So there's absolutely no point being first if you're getting the story wrong. But it keeps people on their toes. So you're pushing people to be first, but also to be accurate as well. The two biggest out-of-the-blue stories I can remember really in my time were the 9/11 attacks in New York and the death of Diana in 1997. I mean, you could argue that there have been bigger stories, certainly bigger stories than the death of Diana. You know, the Iraq war was bigger. You probably say that the whole coronavirus pandemic is a bigger story in national importance, possibly than either of those stories. But to some extent, the definition of a big story, to my mind, partially is something that happens out of the blue, which has what you might call the wow factor. And that is a real, real test of how a news organisation reacts. And certainly when the death of Princess Diana happened on that Saturday night, we covered no other story at all for the following 8 days. And we did it well, and we did it justice. And I'll never forget that. And ditto with the 9/11 the 9/11 story. We won the BAFTA for news coverage for that. It's the test.
Were you in the newsroom when those stories broke, or were you at home?
I was in the newsroom when the 9/11 attacks happened, because if you remember, it was early morning New York, about 9 o'clock. So it was just after, I think, 2 o'clock in London. And I can remember looking at the monitors and seeing it, because there was a gap between the first attack and the second. And we were all stunned, as you might imagine. And the second attack happened, and we all said to ourselves, is that a replay of the first attack, just from a different angle? And then it dawned on us, no, that both towers were then burning. And you don't sit and make a grand plan, certainly for the first 24 hours. You just go with it. And obviously, there was a lot of picture coming in from the American TV networks, but we added our own reporters, our own commentary, and so on. And it was made more difficult, of course, by the fact that then American airspace was immediately closed. So to get extra people in, we flew them to Canada, and then they drove down to New York. But again, that's a story that I suppose we didn't cover anything else for maybe the next 10 days and so on. But on the night that Princess Diana died, that was after midnight, and I was actually asleep and in bed, and the Sky News desk called me, and I remember them saying, look, this might or might not be anything, but the story is that the princess's car has crashed. Dodi Fayed is said to be injured, but there's no news about Diana. I just thought that you can't not go in. So I went in to the office, and I think the news came through about 3:30, something like that, Diana had died. And again, that's one of those things where you are stunned, and you think, what do we do now? The answer is you just keep going. You move the satellite dishes around where they're needed.
I assume as well that there's quite a lot of Certainly with stories about tragedies like that, quite a lot of decisions to be made.
Yeah, a lot of decisions. And I remember the Lockerbie disaster, when the plane came down in Scotland, which was it 88, 89? Can't quite remember. Apologies for that. And I remember that coming through. It was not long before Christmas, and I was at ITN, and we were actually having a sort of meal for editors, a dinner with our wives and husbands and so on. And the news came through. And it came through on pagers in those days, before mobile phones. So all the pagers started bleeping. And we went back to the office, which was just around the corner. And we worked through the night, as you would expect. There was much slower picture flow, as you would imagine. These days, you'd be getting live pictures within seconds of the ground. Terrible. And of course, then you've got a lot of careful decisions. You can't just show live pictures of a scene like that without being aware that you might see horribly mutilated bodies. So that's another judgment and decision you've got to apply. But I remember as the night went on the Lockerbie thing, we started getting pictures in from not only from the scene, but from the New York airport where the plane was due to arrive. And of course, there were relatives terribly distraught. And I remember we showed quite a lengthy sequence of a woman terribly upset. She'd obviously had family on board, and she was crying. And I thought afterwards it was a bad error of judgment. We shouldn't have shown that. Well, that was an unjustifiable intrusion into that woman's grief. I think she was American, so it wasn't like she would necessarily have seen our coverage. But I don't think that's the point. I learned a lesson from that. I mean, there are times when it's okay, I think, to show people's emotional state, but you've got to be very careful with it. And I think if you're showing live pictures, you've got to err on the side of not poking a camera into somebody's face, for sure. But these are all difficult issues that we wrestle with all the time.
I suppose it's important to talk about mistakes and also to watch and read mistakes, because that's how you learn if that sort of situation comes around again for you. I'm quite interested in when people think that they would go back and do something differently.
And I'll give you an example conversely to that. During the Falklands War in 1982, I was sort of still relatively junior at ITN in those days, but we all worked sort of round the clock on that. And although people forget about it now, it was very largely a radio war and a newspaper war. The television pictures didn't come back quite often until about 2 weeks after the particular event. And I remember one day we got pictures back from the attack on the ship Sir Galahad in Bluff Cove, where about 50 Welsh guardsmen were killed. And the pictures weren't horrific exactly, but there were pictures of the survivors being brought on shore. And remember, this is a couple of weeks after it had happened, so the story itself was quite well known. And I remember there was a particular shot of a soldier lying on a stretcher, and he'd lost the bottom half of one of his legs. And rather sort of bizarrely, the top of the thigh was sticking up in the air, I think because he'd lost his leg and he didn't have any balance. It was a pretty grim picture. And we debated quite a lot at ITN about whether we should show this. And the editor said he thought we shouldn't, and we took it out. And I actually thought with hindsight that was a mistake, because this was a war being fought on behalf of the public's name, if you like. And I think you have the onus on yourself, the principle to show what's happening in something like that. I think it was the only shot we ever censored during the war. It's been shown many times since then, but I thought it was a mistake. So sometimes to turn the camera away can be just as much a mistake as it can be a correct decision.
It is fascinating. And obviously, you've got the competition now from people on Twitter who are live streaming images that, as a journalist, you would definitely think twice about sort of sharing. If it's already out there, should you show it?
And now, of course, it's a whole new source of material, what we call user-generated content. And I thought it was fascinating with the story 2 weeks ago now, is it? A week ago, of the attack on Capitol Hill in Washington. And there were some fantastic pictures. You've probably seen the piece by Robert Moore for ITN that ran on News at 10 that night. It was about 7 minutes, and it was the best personal account that came out on the day or within 24 hours of what had happened there. However, in the following week to 10 days, all sorts of other picture came out. A lot of it shot by people who were there as, if you like, part of the crowd. And there's no doubt it did give a completely different view. You saw a much more violent event in progress. And a lot of the broadcasters have done excellent work in pulling together all that user-generated content, a lot of it shot, nearly all of it shot on mobile phones and so on. So the idea that this was just a sort of boisterous crowd, you know, set to shout at the politicians, that really is sort of in the background now. So you've got a more truthful picture emerge, but equally, user-generated content can give you a very misleading picture. Yeah. So it's absolutely beholden on journalists to use their judgment, what you use, what you don't, and what you say about it, what context you put it in, because your job is to try to give people the most honest picture of what actually happened. And it's often very difficult on the day.
I just wanted to sort of finish up by asking you about a bit more about the John Scofield Trust and sort of your work going forward.
Yeah. Well, I have a sort of personal connection with the John Scofield Trust in that it is named after a young journalist called John Scofield. I met him in at ITN during the 1980s, where he was a trainee, very smart guy. He went to the BBC after that, and I think in 1995, I think it was, he was in Bosnia working for the BBC, and he was killed. He was shot by a sniper. He was married, although he had never seen his child. His wife was pregnant, and his wife Susie Scofield has been the driving force behind this John Scofield Trust, and it's run very successfully for 25 years. It's very much associated with the Young Journalist Award at the Royal Television Society Awards. But in a way more important than that, it's now, for the past dozen or more years, it's built up a very good practice for mentoring young journalists, sometimes not so young, but journalists who are in the early stages of their career or just setting out, and trying to open doors for them, trying to support. I think personal support and encouragement is a very underrated part of this, because I think a lot of young people trying to make their way in journalism, it's very easy to get discouraged if either the doors are always shut on you, or sometimes people, they get in, they get a foothold, but they make no progress at all. People don't want to listen to them. So people like me act as mentors. And one of the other really important thing is it shouldn't just be old white guys doing the mentoring. So we have a very wide range of people, and actually quite a few of them are former mentees themselves. I'm never sure that that mentee is actually a real word, but you know what it is, somebody who is being mentored or has been mentored, and that's much better. So if you've got somebody, say, in their 30s, who may have struggled to get into the industry themselves, but has made a success of it, they're great at doing the mentoring, because they've got much more current and perhaps much more empathetic experience. So anyway, I've only been doing it for a few years. I've been a trustee just for a year and a bit. I passionately believe in it. And partly because of what we talked about earlier on, about this suspicion that actually journalism as a career is more closed than it was, more narrow than it was, when people could get into it. You only needed five O-levels in the old days to get a start. If you could find a paper that would take you on or a local training course, people who don't necessarily have qualifications, you know, coming out of their ears, or don't have contacts who will help them open the doors. It has been quite a nepotistic thing. It's been who you know rather than what you know. And I think a lot of news organisations now say they don't just let sons and daughters of colleagues bring their kids in. They have a proper application process for, say, work experience. But, you know, there's plenty for the John Scofield Trust to do. And for people like you in the early stages of your career, I would say any journalist, whether they're affiliated with something like the Scofield Trust or not, should be looking to help other people and to offer advice. We all need a helping hand. I benefited enormously all the way through my career from people that they wouldn't necessarily have thought of themselves as mentors, people who gave me a helping hand freely without wanting anything in return. So I think it's what we should all be doing, whether they're my age or your age or in between.
And that's everything for this week. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Thank you so much for listening. A special thank you to Nick Pollard for taking the time to chat. I really enjoyed speaking to Nick. And you can find out more about the John Scofield Trust and their work at johnscofieldtrust.org.uk, and find Nick on Twitter at @NickPollard2. If you're interested in getting involved or just want to say hello, please get in touch on Twitter through @TheHeadlinesPod or @ Chloe Lavasuch. And I hope to see you again soon. Thanks so much. Bye.